Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's guest is an expert on a variety of things. She's particularly well-versed in the latest research on intravenous vitamin C and its health benefits. IV vitamin C is one of the mainstays of doctors like myself who use natural means to treat disease. And there's intriguing research on the intravenous vitamin C front. We'll also talk about some of the other interesting research that today's guest is involved in. She is Dr. Jeannie Drisco. Dr. Drisco is head of the Integrative Medicine Department at Kansas University Medical School. Did I get your title correct?
That's correct, Ron. Thank you.
And, tell us a little bit about how you got interested in looking at the potential of intravenous vitamin C to treat diseases.
Well, Ron, I want to say before I get started how much I appreciate you thinking of me and inviting me on your show today. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I had the great fortune of trading with Hugh Reardon, Dr. Reardon, from the center in Wichita, Kansas, who is one of the pioneers in intravenous vitamin C. And when I was training with him in my fellowship, I saw patients from all over the world come with all kinds of problems, cancer, fatigue, just many, many different disorders, and treated successfully with intravenous vitamin C. So it was a natural extension for me when I was invited by the dean of the School of Medicine at KU Med to start the program in 1998 to add intravenous vitamin C. It would have been criminal if I hadn't offered it to patients, and out of that came the responsibility to also research it.
So you discovered in your work early on with him, he was kind of a mentor to you, that vitamin C had tremendous potential in treating a variety of conditions. Now, as you know, vitamin C has been controversial because Linus Pauling was one of the foremost proponents of vitamin C. Now there's a lot of dispute about his legacy. A lot of doctors are saying, he got it right about his discoveries in biochemistry, but then he went off on a tangent with vitamin C.
Well, that's so true. They actually thought that because he started on vitamin C later in life that he was getting demented, but actually he was correct and right on. He worked with a Scottish surgeon, Cameron Ewan, and Dr. Ewan and Dr. Pauling both reported together on cancer patients that received 10 grams of vitamin C, and it prolonged their life. Well, Dr. Pauling was so excited about this that he asked the NIH to do a study, a formal study of this, and the study went to the Mayo Clinic. Well, they did it two times with 10 grams of vitamin C and couldn't come up with the same results. And it was only later that everyone realized that the 10 grams that Dr. Pauling and Dr. Ewan Cameron had given were the form of IV vitamin C in the vein. And the Mayo Clinic only used 10 grams orally, which is just a vitamin. And
right.
We know,
I mean, this is really kind of ridiculous, because if a medicine was being studied, say they were trying to discover the benefits of one of the new antibiotics in the treatment of a very serious disease, it would be really scientific malpractice to confuse oral dosing with intravenous dosing. We know that intravenous dosing of medications allows the medication to reach higher concentrations, to penetrate more deeply in the body, so there's absolutely no equivalence between oral dosing and intravenous administration.
Absolutely no equivalence is correct. And the unfortunate thing was that it drove vitamin C underground after the 70s. Only integrative medicine or complementary and alternative medicine practitioners continued to use it. And the rest of the conventional medical crew thought it was malpractice.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, it's sort of like the latest vitamin study, which I'm actually going to, if you don't mind, I'll put you on the spot a little later to comment on. I know that you were involved in one of the studies that was actually published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which was used to debunk vitamins, made the vitamins to seem unworthy of further study. But they say with vitamins and supplements, case closed, and that's sort of what they've been saying about vitamin C for treatment of serious diseases. Case closed after that Linus Pauling lack of success in very advanced cancer patients.
Well, we're carrying the torch now. We've got a number of trials going. Mark Levine at the NIH is our close colleague, and he collaborates with us on many levels. And we're extending that work now into the clinic. We're getting ready to have a paper published in Science Translational Medicine in early February, and it's going to show, as they say, from bench to bedside, the use of IV vitamin C in ovarian cancer. So it's
wow.
It's a plum. Yes, we're very excited about that paper.
Well, that's exciting. I mean, what's interesting about your setup there at Kansas University Medical Center is that unlike some hospitals. For example, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia just banned supplements, the use of supplements by patients. They've just said, look, if you're going to use a supplement, then just don't bring your child here. KUMC, out in, you know, what some people think is the hinterlands of America, is very open to the study of, at the very least, intravenous vitamin C and perhaps other methods in augmenting their success with conventional therapies in cancer patients.
That's so true. We have a wonderful team of conventional oncologists that I work with and share patients with. So it is very progressive in that regard.
And, you know, if they were seeing that these patients were coming to grievous harm, they wouldn't keep sending patients across the campus to get their intravenous vitamin C while they're getting conventional cancer therapy. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And they're also very interested in the nutritional approaches that we have. Specifically now, we were always very careful about carbohydrate and sugar use during cancer care, but we've extended it now a bit further to the ketogenic diet, and we're going to start animal studies in the ketogenic diet with IV vitamin C in the spring of 2014.
Okay, well, that's a little bit of a segue. We're talking about vitamin C, but why don't we open that up? Let's talk a little bit about ketogenic diet and the theory behind it in the treatment of cancer. You know, ketogenic diet makes us think of the late Dr. Robert Atkins as a way to get patients to shed pounds. So how is it now that we're beginning to look at ketogenic diet in the treatment of cancer? Isn't maintaining weight one of the important things in cancer? You don't want patients to waste away.
Well, we're always worried about cachexia or that severe weight loss in cancer. But what we found with a true ketogenic diet, and we have two master's level dietitians on staff that guide our patients through this. So it's not something that we just say, go try this, and they're off. But we guide them through this, and what we're finding is that they do actually maintain weight, and they feel better. The few patients, I have to admit that this is relatively new since.
Yeah, and it's hard to follow, so you have to be a special kind of patient who want to adhere to this.
That's correct, but most of the patients in our clinic get it. I mean, they know if they want to increase their odds of survival and being disease-free, they understand. We teach them about the basics of cancer, the biology of the cancer cell, and what's called the Warburg effect, which I know you're very familiar with, but that cancer cells rely on sugar for their energy and not the mitochondria or the cell power plant for their energy.
So some people will say, well, okay, you know, I've got cancer. This is pretty serious. Time for some really serious action. I'm going to stop eating ice cream sundaes and candy bars, and, you know, so I won't be eating any sugar. Is enough said?
Well, it's not enough. You have to then carry it further into the processed carbohydrates, the Fritos and Cheetos and bagels. In fact, one of our patients went over to the cancer center to receive his chemotherapy, and they give them sack lunches, and he took a little photograph on his iPhone for us and sent it back to us. And, of course, it was a sandwich with turkey and a pack of potato chips and a little thing of cookies. And that was his lunch at the cancer center.
Mm.
So, of course, he had enough sense, but just think of all of that.
I guess they want to keep you happy at the cancer center. It's bad enough having cancer, and then you get, chemotherapy.
Yes,
and
the pink M&Ms for breast cancer.
Right, exactly. So the theory is, in effect, according to a very early 20th century practitioner, Dr. Otto Warburg, who actually has been the bane of many biochemistry students, because what he discovered is what we have to memorize in order to get into medical school. We have to memorize this citric acid cycle, this horribly complicated thing that he figured out in Germany, I guess in the beginning of the 20th century. But that this requires oxygen, but it also requires sugar to work. And sugar comes from any kind of carb. I mean, you could take, brown rice and you get glucose. Whole grain bread of the highest quality, dark bread, that's going to yield glucose molecules, which in theory feed cancer?
If your blood sugar rises, if it is spiking frequently during the day, you are going to feed your cancer cell, yes.
Mm-hmm. And
so what you want to do is rely on fat burning, the good medium chain fats in particular, and really drive that glucose level down. Dr. Thomas Seyfried of Cancer as a Metabolic Disease fame has figured out a formula that's effective, and it isn't just being on the ketogenic diet, but it's also driving that blood glucose down.
When you say a formula, like a supplemental concoction that
formula,
one can...
A formula, no, a numerical formula.
Oh, okay.
That you can plug in and see if you're in a good ketogenic range for your cancer.
Okay, so he's got it down to a science. You can actually monitor whether patients are in the zone, so to speak, for cancer.
Yes, that's
suppression. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then that's coupled with the hyperbaric oxygen therapy and then IV vitamin C therapy, and you've got a 1-2 knockout punch to the cancer.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they say that oxygen is the enemy of cancer, so providing hyperbaric oxygen may offer hope to many cancer patients. In Germany, they also use ozone therapy, but I think, from following some of your research on IV vitamin C, it is your belief, and you've demonstrated this, that intravenous vitamin C offers some of the benefits of things like hydrogen peroxide.
It forms hydrogen peroxide in the extracellular space. That's the space around the cells. It does not form this inside the blood vessels, so it's very safe to give in terms of your blood vessels and your blood elements. But the hydrogen peroxide is formed in the extracellular space at pretty significant levels from our animal studies. We need to now do that in humans. But that does affect the cancer cell in several different pathways that we're working on now trying to understand.
Wow. So what we're seeing is a triple therapy. You've gone beyond just intravenous vitamin C. But explain to our listeners what that entails actually in terms of vitamin C, because some people think, just a little shot of vitamin C. We're talking about truly high doses of vitamin C that have to be administered to suppress the cancer.
Yes, and it's a commitment. So when we interview anybody that's interested in getting help in our clinic, we make them understand that the diet is the foundation and that we build on that foundation. So if they're not interested in the diet, there's no reason to continue with us. So we build on the diet, then we add good nutritional therapies based on their blood levels, and then on top of that, we add the IV vitamin C. And again, we're asking for commitment because it's 2 or 3 times a week, and it's while they're getting their chemotherapy. And once they stop their chemotherapy, we expect them to continue until they're disease-free for a period of time. Mm. So it's a commitment.
And so what often it is said that nutritional therapy is incompatible with chemotherapy. Many oncologists forbid their patients from taking nutritional supplements, or if they find that patients are doing things like intravenous vitamin C, they say, I simply won't treat you. But here it is believed that we can get a synergistic approach, that chemo sometimes is necessary, but that its effect is augmented by some of these other things you're doing.
And we've shown that in our cell tissue and animal work that vitamin C is both additive and synergistic with chemotherapy. So adding the IV vitamin C to the chemotherapy can give a bigger punch, so to speak.
Okay, so a lot of people are going to hear this, and they're going to say, look, I can't find a doctor who administers this, or I can't afford the therapy because, you know, clearly major insurance companies may not cover this. Perhaps you've figured out a way to get that done at KUMC, but not everywhere can that be done. So people are going to say, look, I'm just going to go to the health food store. I'm going to get myself a big old vat of vitamin C. And, you know, as per Dr. Linus Pauling's recommendations back in the 1980s, I heard him say, you know, take vitamin C to bowel tolerance. Take as much as you can. Take 10, 15, 20 grams. He himself said he was taking like 18 grams of vitamin C. That'll do the trick, won't it?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't. And again, we've shown this in our research studies, both cell tissue animal, and we're starting to appreciate this now in human research. But what happens is the oral vitamin C, is because it's a vitamin and it's taken orally, it's tightly controlled. So no matter how much you take, you can only absorb a minimal amount in the bloodstream. But with IV vitamin C, you bypass that tight control and you get a high spike in the bloodstream, and that's what pushes it over into the extracellular space. And we've shown that you cannot get that spike of vitamin C in the extracellular space with oral vitamin C. I don't care what the liposomal vitamin C people say. You cannot get it in the extracellular space.
Well, yeah, that actually is a new trend. New, more expensive forms of vitamin C, the so-called liposomal vitamin C, that is said because of the characteristics of the liposome, a little tiny nano package, that somehow brings it right into the bloodstream so that you get some of the same effects of intravenous vitamin C. You don't think that works?
No, we've shown that it doesn't work, actually. Oh. And you can't get past micromolar levels of vitamin C. It doesn't matter how much vitamin C you use or what form of vitamin C you use. You cannot get past micromolar levels, and it takes millimolar, much, much more, thousandfold more, to get into the extracellular space.
So we've come, in looking at this way of using vitamin C, we've come a long way from the RDA or alleviating scurvy, or the ordinary way in which we might say, you know, make sure you get your vitamins and minerals from a wide variety of foods, you know, use it, you know, use a good diet. You're using vitamin C like a medicine in a way that, I mean, God and nature didn't really intend us to put intravenous vitamin C into our veins.
That's correct. It is like medicine. You're exactly right. We call it pharmascorbate.
Okay. So, justified in the case of, you know, cancer, we're trying to eradicate the cancer. They use far more toxic things, less natural things to suppress cancer growth. So help us out once again. What exactly is the vitamin C doing when we get it to very high concentrations, when we drip it in to a person sitting there in a chair in your IV room? What is happening to the cancer cells when the high concentration of vitamin C hits them?
Well, the good news is the normal cells are completely unharmed. There's no effect on normal cells. But the cancer cells either go into apoptosis, which means they just go into programmed cell death, or they kill themselves, or they simply explode or wither away. There's several different ways that they die, but the effect is if we can drive that intravenous vitamin C into the extracellular space around the cancer cells, and we can get the hydrogen peroxide formed, it will have an effect on the cancer cell.
Wow. Okay. So are you seeing clinical results in all forms of cancer? Because, you know, cancer is very diverse. So we have, on the one hand, prostate cancer. We have gastrointestinal cancers. We have a lot of breast cancer. And we see other cancers which are blood cancers or immune system cancers, lymphomas and leukemias. Are all cancers amenable to vitamin C, or are certain cancers more amenable than others?
Well, of course not. We can never say that we have an effect on all cancer types. And even among cancer types, like breast cancer, for example, we can't predict an effect. So we have to try it and see if it works in a patient. If it doesn't, we stop. But the type of cancer that we have the most difficulty with is the metastatic cancer. Mm-hmm. That's completely walled off in a large mass. And those are more difficult. So widely metastatic cancer is often more difficult. And those cancers are really more what are called stem cell-like. And they also cooperate.
Very, very primitive cells.
Very primitive cells. And so they're harder to eradicate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, they don't behave like normal cancer cells. Normal cancer cells might be amenable to chemotherapy. They might be amenable to the toxic effects of high doses of hydrogen peroxide generated by the vitamin C, or they might be starved by deprivation of glucose. These cancer cells are kind of beyond the reach of some of these therapies.
They seem to be at this juncture. But again, there's more research going on now looking at how these stem cells or these aberrant cancer cells may co-opt the immune system, may even take over the machinery of some of the immune cells. So we're very excited about potential for the future.
Well, absolutely. Well, let's look at, I mean, vitamin C intravenously is not limited in its utility to treatment of cancer. You've looked at intravenous vitamin C in the treatment of many disorders. Why don't you share with us what else it can be good for?
Well, I'm actually writing a little paper with some of my colleagues in the chelation world right now. Terry Chappell, you know quite well.
Yes.
And just looking at some of the controversies in chelation therapy. And one of the things that some of the chelators are talking about now is taking vitamin C out of the mix because it's a pro-oxidant. Mm-hmm. And they're worried about these patients that might have high oxidative burden, like diabetes.
I see.
And so
mm-hmm.
they've done little studies, maybe 6 patients in the study, and then they show if you take the vitamin C out, there's not as much of this oxidation. Mm-hmm. So that's what it's been based on. But when you look at the trial that was just completed, the TAP trial, the trial to assess chelation therapy that used 7 grams of vitamin C in the mix, then in actuality, the patients that had the highest oxidative burden, diabetic patients did the best.
Yes.
So I'm contending that the large trial is telling us don't throw out the vitamin C.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Why don't we remind our listeners what that TAC trial showed? And in fact, there was just a reanalysis of some of the TAC data that made the original data look pale by comparison, that actually the results were even better than they initially showed. And yet, chelation therapy has not been heartily embraced. I'm being
well,
a little skeptical and
of course.
Yeah, I'm being a little bit sarcastic about it because, you know, it's something that's off the beaten track and conventional medicine is loath to recognize it.
Well, they are. And, in fact, when they got the positive results, they thought, how could this possibly be accurate? There must be some mistake, or it's a bad design. But it was actually designed like every other conventional cardiology research project, and the results stand with re-scrutiny.
Yeah, and so for our listening audience, you were actually involved, and I was to some extent, in the initial design of the TAC study. Can you just recap for a couple of minutes what that was about, you know, what chelation is and why it was studied and ultimately what transpired?
Well, the history is interesting, and I think you're probably a better scholar of the history than I am. But the use of chelation therapy has been going on for quite some time, since the 50s. And it was used as the ADTA was used as a binder of heavy metal, specifically lead. But what they saw was when they gave the EDT chelation for the heavy metal properties, the patients that had cardiovascular disease were also finding a benefit. So this was one of those underground therapies that had persisted and had shown promise. And then come along the late 90s when integrative or complementary and alternative medicine was very popular, and they were looking for things to research and study. And a conventional cardiologist, Tony Lamas, picked up the banner of chelation. He didn't actually believe that it would work, but he thought it would be necessary and helpful for patients if he studied it. So he got a $30 million grant from the National Institute of Heart, Lung, and Blood and the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine from the NIH and launched the TAC trial. Again, you and I were in that early committee that voted on the high-dose vitamin regimen and the way the chelation would be administered.
Right. And so this is a highly controversial study. The study was attacked and assailed by critics. They said, you know, don't waste your time. This is quack therapy. And yet, the results were astonishing. And they were presented at the meeting of the American Heart Association out in Los Angeles. I think you were present at that time. And it was a
yes.
Jaw-dropping scenario, wasn't it?
It was. It was really amazing. They had the early-breaking trials, the early-breaking results. And so there was this huge stage full of presenters and critics. And when Tony presented data on the TAC trial, you could have heard a pin drop in the entire auditorium, and it was filled with thousands and thousands of cardiologists from all over the world. And then the critics were very cautious about even responding to the results, but one cardiologist from Duke did say in a interview that's on YouTube that if you take the whole TAC trial, all of the results, and put them together, it's a remarkable story, and it should be looked at further.
Mm-hmm. I think one metaphor for how the results were received by those cardiologists was a little bit like as if they had a Miley Cyrus concert in Tehran. The audience would just be appalled and silent, and I don't think they would have gotten it. It sounds like a similar reaction occurred among the cardiologists gathered there, because it just didn't compute for them that this type of what seems like quack therapy or alternative therapy actually made a difference. And a very unusual thing happened on the way to publication that they actually did publish this in, I guess it was the New England Journal of Medicine, am I correct, or was it?
It was in JAMA.
JAMA,
in
the Journal of the American Medical Association,
yes.
An equivalent major medical journal. And for the first time ever, I've never seen this happen, is they wrote an editorial apologizing in advance for the article that they were forced to publish, because you can't not publish something just because it seems too astonishing. So they said, you know, in spite of our skepticism, we have to say that this was well-performed research and the results are very surprising, and it's thought-provoking. We're not ready to endorse chelation yet, but, you know, nonetheless, chelation did show a benefit. So flash forward to 2014, and what they did was they reanalyzed the data to look specifically at diabetics, and what they found was even more robust benefits in the diabetic patients who'd had heart attacks in the chelation study. Tell us about that.
Well, it seems that when you add the high-dose vitamin to the real chelation therapy, and again, for our audience, we didn't know what we were giving. Everything was blinded. So this was the perfect study. But at the end of the day, when you looked at the high-dose vitamin with the active chelation therapy, there was an astonishing benefit to those patients and to patients that have had what's called left anterior descending artery disease as well. So there's something very special about what's going on with chelation.
I think it was like nearly a 50% reduction in recurrent events, heart attacks or deaths or needs for bypass or stents in patients who had already had heart attacks. So I think it was
yes, that's correct.
That high.
And it's so astonishing that the NIH, National Heart, Lung, and Blood, and NTAM are calling for people to propose research projects that look at what's working in these diabetic patients, because it's so astonishing.
Uh-huh. So, all right. So now, the latest, and I think you were as dismayed as I was. The end of 2013 brought us a whole slew of supplement stories that basically said the case is closed. Supplements are of no benefit. It's time to pack it in for the fraudulent supplement industry, which is basically scamming people, because we have conclusive studies which now demonstrate that supplements don't work. And you happen to have been a steward on one of those self-same studies, because the same study that looked at chelation also looked at vitamins.
That's correct.
So what's your take on that? Because I really think it's a misappropriation of that study. When on the one hand you say, well, chelation, okay, that turns out it's really great, but we're not really going to act on that. On the other hand, we have a study that says, well, the vitamins didn't work in those people, so we're going to act on that, and we're going to claim that nobody should be taking vitamins anymore.
Well, it's a double standard. That's exactly what happened. And the paper that, and I don't know if this, I mean, this is a little of a backstory, but the paper that was submitted was looking at chelation with a multivitamin. And the editors that reviewed the paper at the Annals said, no, take all the chelation out and let's just publish the vitamin data. But they had an agenda. They were going to publish other negative vitamin trials. And if you look at all of the trials that are negative, they'll use maybe vitamin A and vitamin E or some little concoction.
Or something outmoded like beta-carotene,
yes,
you know, which we really don't want to use anymore.
Correct. And or look at longitudinal studies like the Physician's Health Study, where it's really difficult to look at an endpoint. But in any event, the paper, the way the paper was written was changed so that we only looked at vitamin data by itself. And if you drill down on those data, you'll see that about half the patients didn't continue their high-dose multivitamin or any of their oral supplements, whether it was placebo or not, out through the end of the study.
Mm-hmm. So there was non-compliance. There was non-compliance.
Yes. So so we looked at kind of a secondary look, and there's some interesting things that are occurring, and we're going to be publishing those data later. But when you add that multivitamin with the chelation, that story is what you're talking about. It's going to be coming out soon.
You get
a more remarkable effect.
Yeah, that's what puzzles me. You know, in this study that is used to indict vitamins, if you look at the big picture, it turns out that chelation worked. But when you combined it with high-dose multivitamins, actually pretty good vitamins, these, you know, mm-hmm, sometimes we can criticize studies and say, you know, that was a Centrum. You know, Centrum Silver, mm-hmm, isn't going to cut it. That's a, you know, there's nothing there. It's low, mm-hmm, potency. It's poor quality. But actually the people in that study were given pretty good vitamins. So they conclude, well, no, there really wasn't a statistical difference between those who took the vitamins and those who didn't. But actually when patients took chelation plus vitamins, my impression is they did even better than just with chelation alone. That's what puzzles me about that.
That's correct. And so the vitamin paper in the Annals was a little jerry-rigged. And we're now looking at other components of that. I actually ended up writing a safety paper that we couldn't use because of the Annals paper got gutted, and it essentially turned into a safety paper. So I was very distressed about that.
Right. Well, yeah, that's actually an interesting point to be made, is that one thing that came out of this is, you know, there's a lot of criticism about using high-dose vitamins in patients with heart disease. You know, actually, many patients are now telling me when they go to the cardiologist says, look, don't take high-dose vitamin E, don't take multivitamins, because the studies show that they actually can kill you if you have heart disease, that there are negative results. And that absolutely was not seen. There were no negative results in any of the patients given vitamins.
That's correct. And there,
I mean, that's sort of a safety study. On the one hand, you know,
safety study,
yeah,
and it should have been presented as a safety study, but it was lost in the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And that is detrimental to many people.
Right. So you are an interesting type of complementary physician, because you have one foot in the world of the alternative clinic or the natural medicine clinic, but also the other foot in academic medicine. You write papers frequently. You lecture to conventional doctors, and you work together with conventional doctors in a medical center setting. That's not something that I do. I work outside of a medical center setting. Do you think that there really is going to be an opportunity to open the door to alternative medicine, or is conventional medicine trying to shut the door irrevocably on vitamins, supplements, natural treatments?
Well, there's a certain group that would like that to happen, but they're the minority. And if you look at vitamin and herbal sales over the past 10 years, they're just skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. So their claims are falling on deaf ears. And,
right.
and then there's this big splash in the newspaper, you know, last week about vitamin E and Alzheimer's.
Yes, the beneficial effect on, and it was
absolutely.
It was a study in which they compared it to a drug, and the drug didn't really work, so that's bad news for the drug, you know, sell your stock. But actually, the vitamin E, in doses much higher than had been considered in the past, was effective. That may be why some of the supplement studies in the past have been disappointing, and I've said this, is maybe we just aren't using enough. I mean, you may need to use, like with the intravenous vitamin C, you know, 50, 75, 100 grams or more of vitamin C. That would be 100,000 milligrams of vitamin C given intravenously is going to have a heck of a different effect than taking, you know, 10 grams orally.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. And so sometimes people that are doing the research projects don't understand how the therapy is used. Even they might even be at in integrated medicine programs at an academic institution and try and study, like echinacea, I think, is a good example of this. But they don't really understand how the therapy is given or how it's administered. And then it's a botched trial, and everybody says, "See, we told you, this is worthless."
Yeah, and there's a rush to judgment about abandoning the therapy, and we see it again and again. You know, another example of that is a recent study which showed that testosterone was harmful for men with heart disease. The headlines were all over the place, like testosterone harms the heart, when there's so much promising literature that suggests that men with weak hearts, congestive heart failure, circulatory problems, or diabetes do well when they're given testosterone.
Absolutely. And again, it's the agenda. Just as you said, there are people trying to clamp down on this, but the consumer's not going to allow it to happen. And there are other groups at academic centers that are trying to make change as well.
Well, I took the liberty during the weeks when this vitamin controversy was swirling. Every day I would check the stock quotations for big chain vitamin retailers like GNC and Vitamin Shop. And I didn't see their numbers budge. And in fact, at the end of the controversy, the stock prices were higher than at the beginning. So, you know, I think that, you know, it's a very strange world we live in, because we have medical journals making pronouncements about what we should do to get healthy. Take this drug, don't take your supplements. We have editorials even calling forth from the New York Times, don't take your supplements. Dr. Paul Offit wrote such an editorial. And people are ignoring that advice in droves.
Well, the consumer is very savvy these days. They're looking up health information. They're parsing out what they hear, and they're bringing things and trying to educate their physicians. So I think it's an exciting time. I love it when my patient is educated and can bring things to me.
And speaking of education, a lot of people listening to this podcast are probably very excited about some of the things you're talking about. Where can individuals find information about IV vitamin C, or the ketogenic diet in treatment of cancer?
Well, we have a website where we do have some of our research front and center, and that is, do you want me to say it, or do you want to?
Please say it, yeah.
Okay, http://, integrativemed, all one word, .kumc.edu. There is no www in it.
Oh, I didn't realize you were going to give us like a complicated URL. So that's not going to work on a podcast. But let's say,
no.
You know, in this world of Google and, you know, search engines, they put in Dr. Jeannie Drisco, J E A N-N-E.
N-N-E and D-R-I-S-K-O, and they put in KU Integrative Med.
Right.
The KU Integrative Med website will pop up. And we also have a Facebook page now for our KU Integrative Pediatrics.
Okay, so that's how it's going to work. You know, these we can include a URL. You know, maybe when we put up the podcast, but people can find your writings and your information, and as well for health professionals who are tuning in, Dr. Drisco lectures extensively at conferences. Where are you destined to speak next?
I'm going to the naturopathic conference in Arizona in February. The naturopathic conference. Yes.
Oh, in February.
That's
a good place to be in February.
Yes, that'll be very nice. I was thrilled to be invited, and I'm on the program with Dr. Thomas Seyfried of the Ketogenic Diet.
Fabulous.
He's great.
That's going to be very exciting, and hopefully you get some hiking and mountain biking in and some pool time. And, oh, by the way, this may date our podcast slightly because people listen to podcasts anytime they like. For all we know, some people are dialing up this podcast in August when it's hot. But we recorded it in early January 2014. And what's the temperature out there in Kansas City?
This morning it was -6. It was a
-6 in Kansas City. You've lived there a long time, and I won't betray how long that is. But pretty much in your memory, has it ever been that cold?
Only when I lived in upstate New York, in Cooperstown, was it this cold. And I also lived in New York City, but it was never this cold. So.
But for Kansas City can get cold because it is in the interior of the United States.
But this
below zero?
This is a record.
Oh, my goodness gracious. And it's headed out our way. All right.
It is. I'm sending it to you, Ron.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, congratulations on your great work. And, we're going to look to you for continued updates on innovative methods of treating cancer, in particular your work on intravenous vitamin C, which research continues apace. You're gathering more and more information. You have allies in the medical community and the academic community, and we're going to, I think, see a real renaissance of interest in natural therapies for cancer around some of these themes. Thanks very much, Dr. Jeannie Drisco, for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for inviting me.
My pleasure. And thank you, folks, for listening in. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.